Public Commerce Committee to order. One, two, three, four, five bills. The last three bills we're going to do with all the authors at the table and probably not take action on it. That's one with micro beads, but we'll hear the testimony and then today and then take action later. But the first bill up today would be Senate File 1108, Senator Kent. Now, this bill we heard here, we didn't take action. We sent it to the Transportation Committee, and I believe they had a pretty long testimony. So why don't you get started? I see you have a couple of what I call star witnesses up there. Why does everybody laugh when I said that, huh?
But, we like it.
All right, with that, Senator Kent, welcome back to our committee. And like I say, you had a pretty good hearing here the other day, and then I know you had an extensive hearing this week,
yes.
Yesterday?
It seems a long time ago, but yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Blends in all these dates, but proceed, Senator Kemp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And as you mentioned, we talked about the task force report a couple of weeks ago, I believe, in here. And just to do a quick recap, the task force, representing a wide range of stakeholders, met over a number of months, many meetings, very thoughtful investigation of the issues in Minnesota, looking at examples in other states. And the one recommendation that they came forward with that would involve legislation is the subject of Senate File 1108. And what this bill does is it just changes the way that when people go into either register a vehicle or re-register a vehicle or transfer ownership, that it's the way they demonstrate proof that they have insurance. The laws are not changing regarding having to have insurance. The law already says that you're supposed to carry insurance on you when you're driving, proof of insurance when you're driving. All this does is say that currently people attest to having insurance, and now they are going to have to provide three pieces of information. The insurance company's name, the policy number, and the expiration date. And so it is a very straightforward bill in that regard.
Well, if this could get a few more people on off the uninsured roll, it's a victory. I don't know how many we could do, but I mean, we've got to, in my opinion, take steps in this direction. But did you have some testimony from your...
Yes.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm mostly here as arm candy for Senator Kent.
All in favor?
Hey. Getting adjourned.
Oh, I just got here.
That's a term from, where is it, from Moorhead? Or?
It's a fun term.
Some of us city slickers have never heard that one before. Arm candy. Okay, go ahead.
Because you've never been arm candy.
Mr. Chairman, members,
All right, let's get more serious in this body. Okay. Senator Artie Carlson. Joel Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. We strongly support this bill. I was a member of that task force. It was as vetted as it could possibly be. I think we're here just to show that there's support from all sides to move this legislation along, and that's our purpose in being here. Plus, Bob and I wanted to testify in support of a bill together.
Oh, wow.
I think you're on camera, you know.
I know. Is that running?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be briefer. I agree with Mr. Carlson. We support the bill, and I just want a picture of this. So it's an important task force. It's an important issue. Senator Kent vice-chaired the group, and we all are committed to making progress on reducing the number of uninsured in the state. Thank you.
One question.
Another good one.
Thank you. One question.
We're getting a picture taken here.
Go ahead, smile.
Okay, now, Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The current lots is a transfer of ownership, so I'm wondering why, and it was already in law, but it was under that you have to attest that you had insurance, I suppose. But if I'm transferring a car to somebody else, why would I have to show proof of insurance if I'm getting rid of the car?
And the main thing is that when the person is getting the title and registering the vehicle, they have to show that they have proof of insurance.
Well, could you just say then to the transferee? To the buyer?
Madam Chair.
Transfer ownership from the buyer?
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Goodwin, are you looking at line 1.8?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
You have transfers that don't necessarily have a change in ownership. And so when you buy a new car, you show your proof of insurance, but you can have a transfer from family members or others that doesn't require that's why that language is in there, is what my recollection was. And so it doesn't work a disadvantage to anyone, and it doesn't make the seller provide any insurance. It is upon transfer. And you can have that without changing an ownership necessarily. So that's why that language is there. I think it works, and it's been the law for, I think, quite some time.
Okay.
Further discussion.
Just one question to that. So if a car dealership is transferring ownership to an individual that's buying the car, then actually by this language, maybe it's not working that way, but it could work that way, that they could have to provide insurance.
Senator. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, I think it's the operative word is the line above, but it's the owner applying for motor vehicle registration, transfer of ownership. So it isn't in those inter-company transfers, I think. I'm comforted by the current language, but I'm happy to talk with you further about it.
That's fine.
Further discussion on Senate File 1108. Senator Carlson, did you have a?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've had an objection to this, to one part of this, and I did vote against it in the Transportation Committee, and that's because I'm an owner of a classic car, and I would like to buy more classic cars, and they don't carry, you know, you generally don't have to carry driver's insurance on them. You might carry comp. I have comp on my car now, and you would have comp on another car. You might haul it. You might drive it under the coverage of your present insurance on another car, but you don't have a particular policy on the car that you're transferring ownership. So you couldn't transfer ownership unless you bought a policy. So that's, I guess I'd like
to. I heard some of that discussion when I was in the Transportation Committee, and I forget the outcome of that discussion. Senator Kent?
Basically, Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, the requirements to carry insurance on different types of vehicle is not changing. So as of now, the purchaser of your vehicle would have to attest that they have insurance, and now they will have to provide some information about the insurance coverage they have. So,
to that point,
you know, the actual requirements of the insurance they have is not changing with this bill.
Maybe Mr. Kosoka, Senator Kosoka,
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson. So, if you have a company that allows you to have insurance on more than one antique car, then you would simply list that policy number, so you would be covered. If you're with another company that requires a separate policy on each vehicle, then you're going to have a new number. But if your policy covers a number of vehicles, you can just list that number for three of them if you need to. That would be your proof of insurance.
Okay. Mr. Chair, have an insurance agent there, owner error.
And when you're saying that now, that is one of the issues that we talked about in our committee was that and this is actually on a different issue, is that when you list the car on another policy, you're in essence having all the drivers in your home listed on that policy as drivers. Where I have a classic car that has its own policy, and it's just a comp, so it doesn't meet with what we're trying to do. Is we're trying to have people have liability insurance. That's really what it boils down to. I have comp that protects my vehicle from being stolen. And now if I am going to buy another car like that, then I would have to, first take out a policy that does cover that car before I could get the ownership transferred. And, and of course, the effort is to try to get a policy that covers you liability-wise, not just comp-wise. So that's where, and Senator Kent is correct that it doesn't change the requirement, but what I would do is I would just call my insurance agent and I would say, I'm going to buy this car. And by the way, you have 14 days to buy a car. And I would put down that insurance policy. But that insurance policy, according to electronic records, would not show my car.
Senator Kasoka, did you have
Well, first of all, I don't think we're going to be following it up at that level, but you would be technically correct or legally correct that you had coverage in that newly acquired vehicle. And by just carrying comprehensive simply means that you want to bring it home and fix it up and park it. You have no desire to drive it. So that would have you would have met all the qualifications of the law by listing that other policy number because it legally did extend to that. If you then are going to use it and drive it later after you fix it up, then you got to have an insurance policy.
Okay. Well,
that helps a little bit.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank
you, that's good. I think that clears it up, at least with me. Senator Daves, did you have a...
Well, I just wanted to comment and thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you have a collector, an antique car, typically you'll put collector's plates on those. If you put a collector's plate on it, it's for the lifetime that you own the vehicle or on the vehicle. So that wouldn't be an issue.
Okay. Any further ideas, thoughts? With that, Senator Jensen... As it went to your committee, moves that Senate File 1108 be passed and recommended to pass and forwarded to the floor of the Senate. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you for your hard work on this and the task force, too, that you guys, I know you put in a lot of time. Senator Latz, are you? Okay, Senator Latz, Senate File 135. I know this is something we've visited about before and trying to work it out, and I don't know if that's we're there yet, but anyway, welcome, Senator Latz and testifiers, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you can see, I brought my arm candy with me today, too.
Is that a St. Louis Park term, too, or what? How come I... arm candy, how are you guys?
As we say, it's
okay,
in the water.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 135 is intended to level the playing field in the automotive repair and insurance claims processing marketplace. In this market, we have three interested parties. We have the insured or the claimant whose car needs to be repaired. We have the repair shop that makes the repairs. And we have the insurance company who is obliged to pay the reasonable costs necessary to return the vehicle to its pre-accident condition. Everyone relates to everyone else. In addition, there are a whole series of relationships that exist between repair shops and various businesses that provide the goods and services necessary for the repair to take place. For example, repair shops have traditionally had relationships with parts suppliers, on whom they rely on timely delivery of proper parts to effect repairs. The repair shops also have relationships with a variety of vendors who provide them with materials, paint, and tools, estimating and other business software, rental vehicles, customer satisfaction follow-up, and a variety of other goods and services needed for vehicle repair. Independent repair shops have long relied upon those relationships to provide repair services to their customers. They are increasingly seeing their right to conduct their business based on their long-standing relationships compromised by insurance company mandates. What the bill is about is the interest of independent repair shops in maintaining their independence. The repair industry is seeing insurance companies exerting control over as many elements in the repair process as possible. Undoubtedly, insurers have their reasons for doing so, but they fundamentally change the business relationships for repair shops and do not provide benefits to the important third party in this relationship, the individual insureds and claimants who want their vehicles repaired. Nor does it benefit the businesses who supply repair shops with the products necessary for the repair process. After our witnesses' testimony, we'll respond to committee questions, and of course you'll hear from insurance company representatives, and we'll be happy to answer any questions after they make their points as well.
Thank you. Who would like to, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, Wally. Members of the committee, my name is Kevin Wally. I represent the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers of Minnesota. AASP has approximately 700 member shops providing mechanical and collision repairs all across the state. The association strongly supports Senator Latz's bill, Senate File 135, which seeks to strike a better balance between repair shops in the insurance industry and the collision repair marketplace. Maintaining a close working relationship with insurance companies is a very important part of the collision repair business. Repair shops work hard to meet the expectations of insurers, just as they work to meet the expectations of the customers whose cars they're repairing. An important part of success for a repair business is the reputation for quality work that is established over time with people throughout the community. This reputation is carefully developed and maintained by providing quality work and relying on positive referrals from satisfied customers. People come to repair shops because they do good work for them or they've heard of the quality of a shop's work from friends or family. In addition to relationships with their customers and insurance companies, shops have another set of business relationships that provide for their success. Their relationships with vendors, suppliers who provide parts and supplies, paint and tools, estimating and other business software, rental vehicles, and a variety of other goods and services essential to conducting safe, high-quality, and timely vehicle repairs. It is this set of relationships that shops have with their suppliers that is increasingly being compromised when insurance companies mandate the terms for shops to select the goods, products, services utilized, and from whom they may be purchased. There are several aspects of this problem that I will explain in some detail. First, you may hear from insurers that, in effect, repair shops are agreeing to use specific parts vendors or suppliers when they sign a direct repair agreement with an insurance company. But the primary reason shops enter into these agreements is to obtain referrals in situations where an insured has not chosen a repair shop on their own. Signing on to insurance company direct repair programs is essential if the shop is going to survive in today's marketplace, where a vast majority of claims for vehicle repair are processed within the direct repair process, and 85% of vehicle repairs are paid for by insurers. The problem is that direct repair agreements have evolved to the point of establishing market mandates and interfering with existing business relationships rather than allowing for a competitive free market among collision repair shops and their suppliers. This has negatively impacted independent repair shops, suppliers, and consumers in a number of ways. A good example of how these market mandates create problems occurred a few years ago when one insurer required the use of a particular estimating system in order for a repair shop to be included on their direct repair program. To comply, many shops dutifully purchased the mandated estimating system and invested further funds to train their employees on how to use it. Fast forward 3 years later, and the same insurer who mandated the purchase, training, and implementation of a particular estimating system terminated its agreement with that estimating system provider and switched to another. But the repair shops had signed contracts, long-term contracts, with the mandated estimating system vendor and were not allowed to terminate those contracts without penalty. And then to stay in the insurance company's direct repair program, they had to purchase the newly mandated estimating system as well. As a result, all of those shops incurred significant duplicate costs to comply with the insurer mandate. Another more recent example involves an insurance company requiring that a specific parts procurement process be utilized by repair shops. The arrangement imposed under the agreement is for repair shops to obtain parts by utilizing an automated replacement parts locating application mandated by that insurance company. As a result of this requirement, repair shops now often end up with replacement parts coming from parts suppliers with whom they have no experience and no relationship, and in some cases from far-flung locations. Repair shops report that they have experienced lengthy delays in the repair process when parts located by the mandated system were not in good condition or were not even the right parts for the vehicle that the shop was repairing. When those problems occur between a repair shop and a parts supplier with whom the repair shop has a long-standing relationship, the issues are addressed quickly, usually over the phone, based on the trust that has been formed over years in a business-to-business relationship. When substandard or inappropriate parts are delivered from a supplier where no previous relationship exists, every instance where parts must be returned becomes a challenging interaction between two businesses who don't know each other. The result is delay in securing the proper parts, delays in determining financial responsibility for the parts, and the cost of shipping, all of which results in delayed repair cycle time for the ultimate consumer, the vehicle owner. Another insurer practice that is causing problems for repair shops involves specific requirements for securing repair estimates. Currently, insurers may not require insureds or claimants to use a particular shop to have their repair work completed, but some insurers are now requiring that a specific shop prepare a repair estimate, effectively steering the work to that particular shop. The requirement to get more than one competitive estimate is reasonable, but insured should not be steered to particular shops to do so. This bill establishes limitations on what insurers can dictate in the business relationships of repair shops. We think it is think of it as a leveling of the playing field. The insurance industry will testify that requiring certain processes or purchasing relationships can reduce the cost of vehicle repairs. In our view, it has just the opposite effect, as multiple vendor mandates from different insurance companies create added costs and inefficiency in the repair process and negatively impact consumers by delaying cycle time in our repair shops. We need to restore a healthy balance between insurers and the vehicle repair industry, and we believe that allowing repair shops to choose their own products and business relationships and conduct their business in an independent manner is the best way to determine which shops provide timely, competitively priced, and quality vehicle repairs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We have one more witness who's testifying.
Thank you, Mr. Wally.
Thanks.
Mr. Commerce Committee. Yes.
Yep. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Patrick McKinney. I'm the general manager of AAA Auto Parts in Rosemont and East Bethel. We're family-owned and operated and have been in the parts supply business for 33 years. AAA has established relationships with mechanical and collision repair shops throughout the metropolitan area and the state of Minnesota based on our timely delivery of quality parts to the shops who are repairing damaged vehicles. As you've heard from Senator Latz mm-hmm. and Kevin, business-to-business relationships establish a firm foundation for a successful automotive repair. We believe that this is the case for the parts supply business as well. Over a period of years, we've developed a rapport with repair shops that minimizes conflicts to replacement parts and provides open and direct communication and a quick turnaround when there is a mismatch between what the repair shop needs and the parts that we provide. There's no way to replace the positive business relationship that results from delivering reliable service year in and year out. To the extent that the repair shops are required to obtain their parts from sources unknown, based primarily or exclusively on price, the repair shop simply does not know what they're getting into. They may get quality parts at a low price, or they may get substandard parts at a price that really is no better than what they would have received from their regular supplier. They do not have a pre-existing relationship with the supplier, so if something does go wrong and needs to be addressed, there's no level of trust or familiarity between the two parties, and this can lead to complications. When situations such as this arise, there are negative ramifications for the repair shop, for the parts supplier, the insurance company, and ultimately the customer waiting for their vehicle to be repaired. In the example of one insurer's recent mandate to use particular automated replacement parts locating application, there's been a few things that have affected our locally owned business, and we find ourselves doing almost a full extra day's worth of work, 8 hours, due to the redundancy of existing programs that are already in place. There are increased costs for us to participate to the tune of about $300 per month, and one additional sales account manager to assist with quoting the parts. Total revenue is off double-digit percentages since the mandatory inception. And lastly, and most importantly for AAA, the disruption of a long-standing vendor-customer relationship that we spent 33 years in the community building. Insurers should not be using their market dominance to influence and control the parts supply chain or any other aspect of the collision repair process. Repair shops know best how and where to get the appropriate parts for a safe, timely, and high-quality repair. When a third party, such as an insurance company, mandates the use of a certain part, products, or suppliers, it threatens relationship between shops and suppliers that have been built on trust over many years. The best products and services and prices should be decided in a free and open marketplace. This is preferable to forcing shops to purchase through an insurer-mandated process. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I will respond to any questions you might have.
Questions of Mr. McKinney or Mr. Wally or the Senator at this time? If not, Mr. Johnson, did you wish to come forward? We'll have to make room for one more chair or somebody
sit here.
Mr. McKinney, maybe you could be batter up or something, okay?
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I like to be on the left side of the chief authors up here, so I... Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
The Candyman? Oh.
Right. Didn't like that Candyman stuff. I was...
All right, I'll get it.
Anyway.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, and first of all, I won't be able to respond. There's kind of specific company and specific company practices being challenged in question here, and obviously we don't have an opportunity and would appreciate the opportunity to get to the specifics of those. We look for, I'm sure not today, the opportunity to do that. But more importantly, just to kind of at a higher level, and I agree with Senator Latz's characterization up front of the three principal groups that we're talking about, the repair shops, the auto insurers, and frankly, most importantly, the consumers who have damaged cars and are looking to get them back in the pre-damaged condition. But for auto insurers, many auto insurers do enter into contracts, voluntarily entered into contracts with the terms that both parties voluntarily agree to, which if they don't want to, they don't have to. So this bill interferes with the terms of voluntarily entered into contracts. But why are those contracts entered into? Those contracts are entered into as insurers working with the repair shops who voluntarily agreed to do so are looking to improve the process for consumers. And so when those contracts are entered into, they look at completion, time, service levels, equipment, training, pricing. So there's key factors that are looked at. And what's the purpose of that? The purpose of that is to increase customer satisfaction and outcome. Frankly, the results of that, we really have dramatically different stories being told here by two of the three players, if you will, in this equation. From the insurance industry standpoint, these, we'll call them direct repair programs, are extremely beneficial for consumers in Minnesota and across the country. And I'd suggest this, the proof is in the data that we won't have time here at this time to go into in detail, but I would encourage the committee to go into the detail. How are consumers in Minnesota and around the country reacting to the collision repair process, including these direct repair programs? And I've got some surveys from J.D. Power and Associates that does nationwide surveys of consumer satisfaction with the auto claims processes, a GS strategy group. And committee members, here's what these surveys are showing. A continual improvement, positive from consumers' reactions to the repair process, to the results, to the time. What are they seeing? They're seeing faster repair times. They're seeing a cut down on rental vehicle costs. They're seeing potentially for consumers lower out-of-pocket expenses. So the numbers of the consumers, let's put the two interest groups aside, auto insurers and collision repair shops, and look at the consumers in Minnesota. And the numbers are compelling. Over 78% of consumers favor insurance companies being able to recommend a shop, over 78%. And so, again, I don't have the surveys here to hand out, but I would encourage the committee to look at these surveys. So the bottom line, these programs are a clear benefit to Minnesota consumers in the collision repair process. The time, the service, the benefit, these concierge services, it speeds it up, waiting for written estimates, all of that's eliminated. So it's consumer beneficial, and they're voluntarily entered into between contracting parties, the auto insurers and the collision repair shop. So Senate File 135 negatively affects that arrangement. We believe firmly to the negative impact of Minnesota consumers statewide, and believe that we shouldn't change the policy in this way because one part of this contract they don't like the contracts that they're entering into, then they don't need to enter into the contracts. I think it's an important tool. It's working 50 states around the country. And so we should, in my opinion, we should keep that system, not pass Senate File 135, which will interfere with and limit what the terms of those contracts could be. So, Mr. Chairman, I That concluded my remarks. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Lats or Mr. Billy, did you wish to at this time respond or not?
Well, if I could respond just to at least one of the points, Mr. Chairman, with regard to the suggestion that these are voluntary relationships, let me respond by saying that there's at least one insurer in Minnesota that claims to have 70% of their utilization rate for their program, and their aim is to get 90%. And nationwide, 40% of the market is now in these vertically integrated programs, which is to say that if you're an independent repair shop, if you want to participate in insurance repair, you have very, very little room to maneuver. You basically have no choice but to agree to the terms that are dictated by the insurance company if you want to get those, if you want to be in this business.
Do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, and not really a response, but one point that I did make and I should have made, and I think if the members look at the bill, look at the current statute that we have in Minnesota and have had for a long time, and it's really important to point this out. If I, as a consumer who've had my car in a collision, I have the freedom to choose wherever I want to go. So I think it's a key consumer protection in this state, and I personally do this. I have a small repair shop that I take my damage that are likely not in the networks, and I really don't care if they're in the networks of the companies that I work with because I like that shop. And so nobody is arguing or suggesting that there be any change, and it's an important factor that consumers get the bottom line choice on wherever they want to take their car. If they have a relationship with the shop, then they'll keep it, and the insurer is not going to interfere or they break the law if they in any way, shape, or form interfere with consumers choosing where they want their cars fixed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's in Section 72B092, is that correct?
79B092 and just line 1.9, and then
that's
you'll
correct.
See.
The limit of the freedom of an insured or claimant to choose the
shop. In other words,
shop.
It is against the law
to
for
not
an auto
allow.
Insurer.
Okay.
Yeah, and then, yes.
Mr. Willie?
Mr. Chairman, members, we understand that direct repair program contracts are part of the marketplace, and they will continue to be part of that marketplace. What we're focusing on is concern with those requirements that are increasingly being brought to bear in the context of those agreements where redundant systems are required when shops end up doing business with more than one insurer, and it's creating a real imbalance in the relationship between the repair shops and the insurance companies that has to be addressed. As Senator Lats mentioned, the circumstance now is one of a real imbalance in that power relationship. We're just trying to find some common, well, not common ground, but a level playing field for people to operate in.
Okay, it seems to me, and I think the parties have kind of agreed that there's a little more work in progress. Is that correct? And maybe if it's all right, we could set it down to the subcommittee on insurance to take a further look at it. Would that to keep it going? And it's not my intent to kill anything, but I think I've got some word that would be all right. Is that, Mr. Willie, did you? Because I think Mr. Johnson or somebody indicated that there's a heck of a lot more discussion, and we've got five more bills today. So I don't know if that makes sense.
I can accept that, Mr. Chairman.
Would you accept that, Senator Lats?
Yes.
Okay, anybody in the audience or on the committee wish to have any remarks at this time? So I think what we're going to do is honor Senator Lats's request to send this to the Insurance Subcommittee, Senate File 135. On that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much. I know we've been kind of looking at this thing for about 2 years now, and maybe we could get some kind of consensus. I don't know. Senator Jensen, Senate File 26, Self-Service Storage Insurance Agent Sales and Licensing Regulations. Is this a substitute for the bill?
Yeah.
Is that
serious?
Is that 82?
She has it. Yes.
I think we're passing out an amendment that puts the bill in the shape that the senator would like to have it in.
Yes.
And what?
Mr. Chair, it should be the A2 amendment.
That'd be the A2 amendment. Why don't we we'll do that. Senator Jensen moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 26, basically what it does is it establishes a way for self-storage facilities to offer and for consumers to obtain limited insurance coverage for the loss or damage of personal property that they have stored in a self-storage unit. The limited self-storage insurance is designed to fill a gap for consumers and to protect the owners. Currently in Minnesota, if you don't have a homeowner's or renter's policy that covers your property in a self-storage unit, you're left with few, if any, options to protect your valuables from loss or damage. Should a fire, severe weather, or any other destruction occur, you're basically left without any relief. So for several reasons, and some, my understanding is due to some real heavy, severe natural disasters that happen with hurricanes and other reasons, facilities have started to require tenants to provide proof of insurance as a condition of their rental. So that's in current practice today, and they're able to do that. There's no issue for those with homeowners or renters policies to provide that coverage, but if you don't have any of that, and for instance, if you're in transition and you don't currently have a homeowners or a renters, you're left with a couple options. You can go and try to find somebody that will sell an individual policy for what's called tenant insurance, or you can try to find a facility that isn't requiring the insurance. Those are your two options available. The legislation that I'm putting forward tries to address that gap by providing a regulated path for consumers to get self-storage insurance. Currently, there are 20 states that administer some type of limited self-storage insurance programs, and it's about 65% of the facilities nationwide. The parameters of the self-storage insurance policies vary and are generally priced. They're about $8 a month, but you can find them at all different levels. And I think the biggest advantage, and I'll just talk about this a little bit, of the biggest advantage and differences between a homeowner's and a renter's and the availability to buy a plan from the storage unit is the time frame of the policy. So if you have a homeowner's policy, that lasts the entire year. But if you're only going to store your items for a couple months, you can buy this limited insurance to cover that particular time frame, which is a lot easier for consumers to deal with. And then there are coverage differences that you're only limited to if you have damage through a homeowner's or a renter's policy based on the coverages that you have on your current policy. If something isn't covered on your current policy, it's not covered in the storage unit. So if you want to cover something like water damage or rodent damage or vermin damage and you don't have it on your current homeowner's or renter's policy, it's not covered. But with these policies, it possibly could be included. And a lot of states have these policies that have been provided include some of that kind of damage that has been occurring. When you think about even mold and mildew, those things have been added too, which might not be on your current homeowners or renters policies. The other thing is deductibles. So if you're using your homeowners or your renters policy, you're forced to use the deductible that's on those policies. But if you buy a tenant policy, you could choose what kind of deductible you wanted to have with that property that's located in the storage unit. So those are some of the advantages that I see for wanting to make sure that we allow this to happen.
Sell this policy, Senator. I think you have to ask the owner or the renter if it's covered under their homeowner's policy or rental policy already. Is that correct? And they might have it, it might be covered already on their homeowner's policy.
Well, the way it currently works in the market right now is if you're going, looking for a place to store your items, you would look at that facility and they might require you to have insurance or they might not. If they don't and you have a homeowner's policy or renter's policy, your property might be protected under those. You'd want to check with your agent and make sure that
that's my point, that you may be covered already.
Which within this bill we have put in language to make sure that if they're currently requiring. You've got two things that are going on in the marketplace. Either they're requiring you to have some proof or they don't. So if you're at a facility where you don't, if you have a homeowner's policy, typically you get coverage worldwide for property that you have stored somewhere else. Okay. So that's why we included in here that if somebody's requiring it, and this was very important to have in the bill, if a facility's requiring it, the homeowners and the renters or some other policy qualifies and you don't have to buy the insurance that they're offering. But if you don't have that and you need to get it in order to use their facility, what options do you have then? So your option is to go try to find an agent if you don't have homeowners and renters and try to get one and maybe you're in transition and you can't get it. Or you try to find another facility that is not requiring that insurance in order to rent their space.
So you have that option to shop around if you'd like. Senator Kozelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, I'm signed on to the bill too. I like it. I just want you to confirm that if there is a loss and they take out one of these self-storage policies, that this is primary. In other words, it pays first. You know, so even if they had a renters or homeowners and they did take one of these out for those extra potential coverages, rodents, water, mold, this is primary. And the reason why I'm asking that for the committee is because a lot of homeowners have a $1,000 deductible, a $2,500 deductible, a 1%, which could be $5,000, $6,000. And these would be lower deductibles, which means they'd have much better coverage in storage. So if you would confirm that, that would be good.
Mr. Senator Chair Jensen. And Senator Kozelka, yes, this would be their primary insurance, and it would pay first.
So you could have two policies,
yes.
One in your homeowners and this one.
Yeah.
Senator Daves, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen.
Will there be something in this when the house is being sold, something that the
she understands?
Policies.
I think that's very important that when people buy these policies that they understand that there's absolutely no liability provided in this policy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, we've added actually on page 2 not specifically liability, but that they have to disclose the policies offered and that there is a very strong disclosure that they have to provide that this is, might duplicate other coverage, so they might have it under their homeowners. Let's see. Where is the particular? 2.1, including the indemnity of the insurer, premium amount, benefits, exclusions, and conditions. That has to be provided to the consumer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Davis.
Just to follow up, at some point as this moves through, it may not hurt to make sure that there is a provision in there that specifically describes that there is no liability in this policy, because I think that's very important. And having been an insurance agent for several years, I know when people come in and buy insurance, a lot of times they're not hearing everything that you're telling them. And so then there's a loss, then you start running into problems. So if you have that very well disclaimed that there is no liability in here, I think that it would be to everybody's advantage, the buyers and the sellers.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I have no problem putting that language in this bill.
Thank you.
Let's see. Did we want to figure out some wordage now or take a few more questions? And Council, did you hear what the suggestion was?
How about on page 2, line 2, after the after conditions, and that there is no liability coverage provided under the insurance.
Senator Dames, does that meet your approval?
Yes, that'd be
fine. Yep. Senator Jensen, is that all right?
Mr. Chair, that's perfectly fine.
Everybody understand the oral amendment?
It's off the amendment. It goes on to that amendment, doesn't it?
All those in favor of the...
Just one quick question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin, on the amendment.
Are you talking about personal liability?
So if you get hurt in the unit or whatever, then it's not covered?
Oh, no, this, Mr. Chair.
Senator Daves.
This would not be liability for you personally. This would be liability for you. Let's say that you have a storage unit, and let's say that you are taking stuff out of the storage unit. Unless you got a lawnmower sitting out there and you started to move it out self-propelled, you don't shut it off, the lawnmower takes off and causes damage, you would hit somebody. I know that's a real reach, but just to give you an idea, you'd be responsible for that. This policy would not provide any liability for that. And people need to know what they're getting when they buy this policy. I think it's a good idea. But I also think there's room for a lot of issues if we don't have it specifically explained that there's no liability, so people don't assume that if they do something they're negligent for outside the unit and somebody gets hurt or they cause damage, that this is not going to provide any coverage.
Then, Mr. Chair, this would only be for outside of the unit. If damage happens outside of the unit, what if they
any liability, Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, it's excluding any liability. Any liability you would be held accountable for due to the storage unit is excluded. This policy would not cover that. This just makes people know that it's not covered. I'm not changing. My request is not to change the coverage in the policy. It's just making sure that people buying the policy know what they're getting.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but everybody's not inched in that smart about about insurance terms, and I'm wondering if that shouldn't be somehow described better than just that, so they know what coverage they're not getting. I mean, liability, just to say liability coverage, I don't think really describes it very well, so they know what they're not getting with this. They know what they're – I think that's a good idea to put what they're not getting with this, but I'm just not sure that just saying they're not getting liability coverage is enough for some people.
How do you talk?
Mr. Chair.
I think that would be explained at the time, but Senator Jensen.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's why we put, you know, exclusions and conditions, but I understand the point that Senator Dames is trying to make, to make sure that in particular – because this is insurance to cover your property. So that would have to be understood.
That's the intention of the bill.
Yes.
Of the bill to cover the property. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Daves wants to make crystal clear that that's the case.
Yes.
Mr.
I
Chair.
I believe.
Yes, that is
Senator Kasauka, did you have a
question? We could have them contact their attorney to make sure it's okay.
Oh, come on.
We have to add some FTEs in, or for any reason here? No.
I'm sorry, I'm kidding. I think it's a good amendment.
I think I think Senator Goodwin, this, I think for the very consumer, very this very would spell it out a little bit better for them, so they know up front what's covered. That's what I get out of it. With that, Senator Daves moves the amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Dahl, did you have a comment?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, you know, we've all been to the airport car rental place, and they're trying to sell you insurance you don't need, and we all know I don't need it, and I learned to say no. And my wife has now learned to say no because we're covered. But, you know, I worry about that happening at the storage facility as well, where I don't know that my homeowner covers this. And while the fact, wouldn't they make a commission the more they sell? And, and the fact that we're offering a product that very well isn't needed. And sure, we can hand them a, you know, big, thick, old insurance thing, say, read that. That's your disclosure of fees. But I worry about the additional cost, but the incentive for these storage facility owners to want to sell, because they're probably going to make a little bit more money in a product that's probably may or may not be needed by the consumer. So those are some of my concerns.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl. And, well, I'll try to remember, so you might have to remind me the points that you made. But we have added in here that they can't get any incentive payments or anything like that for the number of things that they sell. When you go and rent, do a rental, car rental, and you decide whether or not you want to buy the insurance that car is rental agency is offering you, you can make that decision because you have auto insurance. And within that,
the reason you need to talk to your agent about it is there are some gaps even within that. So if you are driving a rental car and you get into an accident, you're covered through your auto insurance, but they might not cover the loss of the income to that particular business. So there are gaps even within that kind of coverage. So if you crash the car and you total it and they can't use it in their business for a certain number of days, the insurance company can charge you for that loss unless you purchase their rental agreement. So what this is meant to do is to cover those gaps just like that and to provide those choices to the consumer where they're able to decide a different deductible, they can get better coverages that they don't have, and if they don't have current insurance, just like you would choose the rental if you didn't have auto insurance currently. This provides that opportunity for the consumer.
Along that same point, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think Senator Dahl seems to be onto something here. But hopefully it's covered all right. Because I know that insurance stuff at the airport is pretty hard sell. I've convinced my wife to use the word no also on that. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm also supportive of Senator Dahl's points, and I'm looking at line 2.28 to 2.32, and it talks about incentive payments and production payments and that nothing in the section prohibits them from accepting that, which then tells me that they would be pushing this insurance, not just offering it, but actually they'd have the incentive to really push hard on it. So can you explain that to me? Can you explain what this is, the commission and service fee and for the sale and production payments or incentive payments? What's that all about?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. This is set up to mirror what happens currently with auto, and that's where this came from.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. But that's just what we're saying we don't like.
Yeah.
We don't like that pushing of the insurance when you don't need it. So I would like to make an amendment to take that out. Section 2.28, 2.32, and actually make some protective language for the consumer that they're not. This is not being pushed down their throat when they don't know whether they have insurance or not already.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
There is language in here that says that they have to make it clear that if they already have, that this could be duplicative insurance, and that if they already have homeowners and renters and others, that this would be duplicated.
Could you
to make the consumer aware of that and that they don't have to buy it unless it's something that they want to buy. Now, because there are some facilities that do require the insurance in order to rent their space, you would have to go somewhere else in order to find, if you're not wanting to, but they're not requiring you to have to buy the insurance. It's just an option and available.
Mr. Chair, could you describe to me where that section is that you're talking about? And Mr. Chair, and do you have to provide that in writing or just disclose it?
It needs to be in the brochure type information that you provide to the consumer, which is on 1.35,
okay,
the owner makes readily available to the prospective occupant brochures, and they have to disclose on 2.3 that the policies offered by the owner may provide a duplication of coverage. But I just want to make clear, if you read on 2.32, it says that the payments are not they're not dependent on the sale of insurance. That's what we have in the language already.
But they can be, excuse me, Mr. Chair, they can receive compensation for
they can receive commission, but they can't receive anything based on the number of sales that they do.
Mr. Kosoka.
Mr. Chair and members and Senator Jensen, This is not quite like the car rental situation, because I do the same thing that you do, Senator Dahl. I never do it. There's a whole bunch of people that don't have a renter's policy or homeowner's policy.
Yeah, like 30%.
They're just moving their stuff around. And I don't know what the price point is on this product, but you know, for me personally, if it was in the $40 range or whatever, I'd absolutely buy it to get water damage and mold and rodents, which are typically not covered under homeowner policy or renters. So it's going to cover a lot of people that have nothing, and they just want to insure their stuff. And then there's other people like me that might do it just because there's a lot of things on a homeowner policy that would not be covered under or that would be covered under this. And so I don't mind that they get paid. You know, this potentially takes business away from the property casualty writer, but okay. I think it's a place where there is a gap that we could actually fill in.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Jessup.
The statistics, so what we see is 80% of renters don't have renter's insurance. So you're talking about 80% of people renting wouldn't have anything, and that 50 to 60%. Oh, 50 to 60% of the people are in transition. So they might not need a renter's or a homeowner's. And if they're in transition and trying to do that, which is different than you're correct, Senator Gazzacco, that is different than auto.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm worried, though, that the facility, storage facility gal can require insurance. They can require it. So you've got the seller. The person requiring it is also selling it. That's just concerning to me. Mm-hmm. And the last piece I might mention, you know, the section you referenced, 228 to 232. I don't know who oversees that or regulates that or who has authority to enforce that, but that's just concerns I have.
Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I sit here and listen to this, I really think we need to give the consumer. I think consumers are a lot better consumers than what we're thinking they are. I think we have to give the consumers some credits here. I think they'll understand this, and I think it is an opportunity for them to buy something they currently can't buy now. I guess I don't get too concerned about the fact that the person that has the rental unit renting it is probably also the same person selling the policy, because trust me, if you're looking at a $40 policy or something in that neighborhood, the commission they're going to get on that is probably going to cover the paperwork to do it if they're lucky. So they're not going to be doing this to earn money. They're going to be doing this to provide a service to their clients. So let's give the consumer some kudos as to being able to understand some of this stuff and being able to make some decisions. I think too many times when we make decisions, we assume that consumers can't figure any of this out, and trust me, they can and they will, and this is a good program, and I think right now we're just overthinking it.
Mr. Chair, one quick question, please.
Senator Goodwin.
I just want to know, doesn't the storage owner have any responsibility to have insurance? And what happens, for example, if there's bad roof and your property gets damaged because of a bad roof or something? Now, are you going to have to, your insurance is going to have to cover that? Or doesn't the storage facility have to have
I would think insurance that'd be different, for, but Senator Jetson.
That should cover the what's in the units?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. The insurance policy that the storage units have are to cover their property, but they do have to pay if they are responsible for, and have control over any damage. So if there's a leaky roof and it damages your property, they do pay currently, and they would continue to do whether we did this or not.
If they're negligent,
they will pay, and their insurance policy will pay. But if there's a natural disaster and there's a tornado and your stuff goes, they can't handle that. That's where this kind of coverage would help with that, too.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess from the senator or from Senator Gazzacco, because he seems to know a lot about this. But, and you also mentioned that this has to be primary. Is there a place where this is specified to be primary? And also where the deductible can tend to be reasonable? For instance, if I'm going to buy insurance and it's $6 a month and it has a $1,000 deductible, then it really isn't insuring me. You know, and so is there, you know, is there someplace where this, it, we make sure that there is a reasonable deductible or no deductible, and that it isn't also the deductible, wind up being the same deductible as your homeowner's policy?
Good.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, my understanding is because it's a lower deductible, it would be the primary insurance that would pay and settle in current law.
Senator Champion, did you have a question or concern?
I did have a question. And I'm trying to put it all together here, Mr. Chair. But I'm trying to understand, what is the interest? What interest does the storage facility have to require insurance?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Senator Champion, my understanding and the reason that it's gone through 20 states and 20 states have implemented this is because in situations, especially the one that's the largest is when there were hurricanes that happened, some of the lawsuits that ensued from that for the storage units, and that they were losing their losing those cases and had to make payments without understanding, because they're not insured. The storage unit doesn't know what is in the storage unit. They're selling the space, and they don't go in and look in inventory. They just ask that you don't store more than $2,000. So there were court cases that these owners are having to go through. So that's why they started requiring that you have insurance. So I know, they know, you have a renters, a homeowners, or whatever it is that's going to protect them so they don't go after the storage owner for payment of their property.
So I'm just...
Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I think about this, so if I come as a person who wants to rent storage, and if there's a requirement for me to have insurance, it's my understanding under your bill, the storage facility can require it, and they can also be the seller, or they cannot be the seller. Help me understand.
Mr. Chair? This bill doesn't do any requiring of any insurance. It lets the owners know that if they do require, that homeowners will work, your renters will work. But if you don't have any of that and you still want to protect your belongings, you can get the insurance from them. So it's a service to their consumer to make sure that if they want to have that if they want to use that facility and don't want to go search for insurance somewhere else, they can purchase it there and then get their property covered.
My rental unit has my rebar and my campaign signs, and I'm not going to insure this. The A to Z rental in South St. Paul is not going to sell me this product, but that's some people say my signs are a little old too, probably because my age. But any further discussion on this, Senator Jensen? I think. Pardon? Bill, did you have another?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to give consumers more credit, but sometimes they need protections, and we've not just at airports, but the extended warranties on that TV that's already outdated and every other thing that you have in your house. But I would just say sometimes they need protections, and I'd rather see a notice that instead of this requirement to buy insurance, the stuff in your storage shed is not insured. Okay, that would be a sign off on that then. That was not liable. So that's all I wanted to say.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Champion.
Thank you. It just seems to me that the question still hasn't been answered, because I just feel a little uneasy about the direction that this particular bill is going, is because the storage facility still haven't answered the question, and so I just want you to know that I'm a little uncomfortable with the direction that this bill appears to be going.
Okay, those are legitimate questions.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We did a lot of work last year too, and Senator Dahl, we made some changes that required a lot of disclosures on that up front. So I want you to know that we did work on that last year and passed that into law last year. So are we ready to move the bill?
Senator Carlson, before the vote.
Yes. Yeah. I just wanted to say that I when I first heard about this, I liked it. But then when I found out that the rental can be prohibited, the rental can be denied if you don't have insurance on your own things, that you don't want to, that you are now willing to take the risk of your own property, and you can't rent if you don't buy that insurance that the renter is offering to you, that makes me feel like you're, as a consumer, you're caught in a tight spot. And I think if I were a mini storage company, of course I would require it. I think all of them will. So you don't really have the choice of going someplace where they don't require insurance. So I'm concerned about that, just like Senator Dahl is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, that would happen whether we pass this bill or not. That's happening now. What this bill does is provide consumers the ability to get it if they want to store it. That we're not doing, we're not requiring, we're not changing anything in the marketplace. All we're doing is providing an opportunity for the consumer. So what you're, the scenario you're talking about will actually be, will continue and will grow. This is to address that, that very thing that you're talking about.
Carlson, follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Senator, that's correct in a part, but what we're doing is we're setting up the mini storage owners to be in the business of selling that, and also they get the gain from it. So that is different.
Okay.
Okay. We're ready to vote. And this motion will be that Senate File 26 be recommended to pass, and it goes to the Senate floor. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Further discussion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
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 Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Jensen, would you give I believe you're not going to proceed with, at this point, with the Senate File 1148. Would you give a very brief explanation of why we're not moving right now on this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1148 came out from a desire and to try to clarify and get a better understanding of what happens in the MNCHA assessments that take place. So what the bill was asking to do was say that no assessments would occur for a contributing member effective July 1st, 2015. I am under the understanding now and have been working with people to make sure that MNCHA's the initial transition plan, they were required to do a transition plan to make sure that the assessing and how are we going to get members off of the program needed to take place. They have indicated to me that, and they might come up and say a few words about what we discussed and how we can go forward and handle this question.
You just welcome to the committee, and I state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Tim Vande. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Commerce in charge of the Insurance Division, and was identified as part of the MTRA transition team and delegated authority with respect to closing MTRA. The comments that Commerce would make would be that at the fourth quarter assessment, we made sure with working in consultation with the board of MTRA that we would first have sufficient funds to cover the remaining MTRA enrollees that we anticipated, as well as any coverage disruptions that may occur. And secondly, was to make sure that we had made it conservative enough to not require an additional MTRA assessment in 2015. We have scheduled a finance committee meeting for MTRA to discuss, and part of the agenda for that meeting is the fact that or one of the agenda items will be the assessment itself in 2015, and we expect at that meeting to confirm that no future assessments will be necessary for MCHA going forward. We believe that this bill may be premature, just given the fact that we're still in that fluid motion.
So with that, Mr. Chair,
I don't want to continue assessing too much longer on the business community, but Senator Jensen, agreeing
Mr. Chair, I will be watching the transition meeting next week, and we'll see what, I mean, I take them at their word that this is something they're going to take up and let us know what's going to happen within that transition plan, and understand that I am very concerned that we have to let the business community know what the assessment process is going to be within the transitional plan, and I'm comfortable that is what will happen, and I'll follow it, and if I need to do something at a later date, then I will do so at that time.
Yeah, we want to, if you're comfortable doing that, but I think we don't want to continue taxing our small business community any longer than we have to in this area. And MCHA, you got the word, and you understand what we're trying to do here. Okay. I think that's good for now.
Yeah, 12 minutes to do micro beads.
We're going to next go into the micro bead sale prohibition. We've got three authors for discussion only today, and then we'll figure out which bill or combination of the three bills. And the authors are Senator Marty, Senator Reinhart, and Senator Hoffman. We've got the Highway Patrol out looking for two of these people. And, what was that word about that candy that we talked about earlier?
Farm candy.
Farm candy.
Is that kind of a
because it's the same here.
So. Okay, we'll talk about arm candy. Senator Reinhart.
It's big on social media.
Is it? Okay, I didn't know that.
What is that?
Arm candy. It's where we all get our social media?
Yeah.
Is that okay? But he was napping away. Senator Reinhart, you can get started on your bill, and I know this is kind of a real problem up on
Lake Superior.
I understand. I've read about that or heard about that, but welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, with your suggestion or permission, I think what I'll do is just call members' attention to the three bills. My bill, which is Senate File 627, Senator Hoffman's bill, 674, and Senator Marty's bill, 507. I can make some opening comments. I know, Mr. Chair, there are testifiers, so then we could turn it over to testifiers to comment on the three bills. Members, all three bills deal with the issue of microbeads in the Great Lakes. Last summer, we had a very good delegation from Minnesota, Democrats and Republicans that attended the Great Lakes Legislative Caucus, and we had a pretty in-depth discussion on this issue. Members, you may have paid attention to the issue of plastics making their way into the Pacific in this growing sort of plastic island now about the size of Texas in the Pacific. The same issue is happening in the Great Lakes, and a particular concern to me, since I represent a district on Lake Superior, is that in the Great Lakes chain, Lake Superior, the problem in Lake Superior is multiples of what it is in the other Great Lakes, primarily because of Lake Superior's size. Members, you may know that a significant amount of the world's fresh water is contained in the Great Lakes. And
excuse me, Senator Marty, would you like to join at the front table here?
And in particular in Lake Superior. And members, the problem is made worse by Lake Superior's average colder temperature and slow turnover. A drop of water that enters Lake Superior today will stay there for the next century. So the microbead plastics contained in many personal health care products are too small to be screened out by our sanitary systems and end up in the lake and stay in the lake and then enter the food chain and the ecosystem. And I think what you'll hear, members, from testifiers about the three bills is not a lot of disagreement that there's an issue that we ought to address, and most Great Lakes states are. It's more how do we go about doing it. So, Mr. Chair, with that and your permission, I'd invite Senator Marty to make some comments as well.
Thank you. Before that, we'll send Senator Hoffman will join the three amigos.
At least they're not arm candy.
Huffy Jr., welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a staff go get my. I left my notes downstairs, so if it obliges.
Before you have a heart attack, would you like Marty to start, Senator Marty?
I would love Senator Marty to start. That would be wonderful. So
I don't care, Senator Marty. Would you? Sure. Why don't you? You were first to sit down.
Mr. Chair, yes, this issue is one that is happening. I think a number of states are moving forward with this, and we had some good testimony in the Environment Committee and so on about the problem with this. This is something that I think a lot of us didn't know existed until a few years ago, and then certain people were manufacturers using these very tiny beads, which Senator Reinert gave us some samples of. I think I left them upstairs. But they use them for various purposes to gently scrub the skin or whatever. And they do cause some of the problems that I didn't hear all of his testimony, and I think we have some witnesses that will go into more detail. But the difficulty is they don't break down in the environment, and they do tend to gather toxins, sort of stick to the plastic, and they are eaten by some fish. They go up the food chain that way. It's very harmful problem, and we've met with industry and actually have an amendment I can present a little bit later about the types of things trying to address some of the concerns they have. But what we want to do is make sure that we get rid of them. I think the dates and so on aren't nearly as important as make sure we actually get rid of them. And one of the issues is I want to make sure that we define a plastic bead is a plastic bead, and then if somebody comes up with some that really do break down in the environment and are okay to use, allow an exception where they can make a case to the PCA that those are biodegradable in our natural environment. Lake Superior and our lakes in Minnesota are not warm places, and these plastics break down very slowly, and so therefore as I've talked with manufacturers and so on, I understand their concerns about other things. So I was suggesting, and my amendment would address the concerns, but I do want to keep it that we make sure that we're not allowing things that are pseudo or that might break down in certain ideal environments but won't break down in Lake Superior and so on.
Yep. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 674, as with you heard from Senator Reinert and Senator Marty, is a microbead-related bills, and we're bringing it to the forefront. As we heard in all the testimony, it's clear that Minnesota and its personal cleansing industry agree that microbeads must be eliminated from these products. The legislation I bring levels the playing field for both domestic and international manufacturers and also provides adequate time for smaller manufacturers to comply. In summary, the bill bans manufacturing of products with microbeads, bans retailers from purchasing products with microbeads, and it preempts municipalities, counties, or other local governments from prohibiting synthetic plastic microbeads to ensure a smooth statewide transition for retailers and distribution. Industry supports the phase-out of manufacturing of personal care products with microbeads. What we're saying in our bill is the industry needs sufficient time to make the product formulation decisions well in advance of new production deadlines. Without sufficient time, our industry may not be able to meet other regulatory requirements. As you know, the provisions of the Federal Food, the State Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act that is out there as well. And then specifically, these changes to product formulation must ensure that reformulated projects are stable and suitable for consumers. And then finally, companies need to conduct safety testing and environmental safety assessments of alternatives and need some ample time to do so. So that's the difference, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'll stand with these other two wonderful senators and stand for questions.
Talk to me just a little bit more about the effective dates. I think Senator Marty kind of zeroes in on December 31st of 17, and I believe Senator Hoffman Hoffman, does yours give a little more time to sure. Is that what I'm reading?
Sure. Mr. Chair, in talking with the industry, I came up with it's an A6 amendment that should be in your packets, which takes the timeline that they were most comfortable with, namely 2017 for manufacture of personal care product and 2018 for over-the-counter drug, which basically means toothpaste. And a year later for the sale of them, the timeline, and in that case, with that amendment, would be about the same, and we'd be taking out the subdivision 4 of Senate File 507, which is the penalty section. It would be the same timeline for all of them. So basically, the remaining difference would be that we're trying to say that instead of defining microbeads as non-biodegradable plastic, we're saying plastic microbeads are plastic microbeads. What we're saying is if they can show that it does, if it really does break down and they can show it, then they can have an exemption for that. So that to me is the gist of the distinction to make.
This bill, I'm told, we're not going to take action today because it's going to meet the deadline in the House. So we're going to kind of figure out the best of all worlds here if we can and see at the end of the day which we're going to. Senator Reinhart, did you?
Mr. Chair, I would just suggest that maybe we do put the A6 amendment on to Senator Marty's
bill. We have the A6 amendment?
We do not.
Because these page has it now.
With the A6 amendment, Mr. Chair, all three bills would reflect the same phase-out timeline.
Okay. I don't think we have the Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I heard the amendments coming. I'm just wondering if this, because the time's getting short, if these bills or this bill or if you're going to coalesce around one bill, if it has to go to any other committees, because then it might be a good idea.
I think it's already been
passed. Does it have to go to health?
Mr. Chair, it's been to Environment Committee, but Health Committee has requested it yet.
There is one more stop, but I've been told that we're going to meet the deadline in the House, so that gives us time to do it this right. So anyway, yes, Senator Pappas, it does have one more stop. Is that correct?
I know of one, yeah.
Okay.
You think we should put that amendment on now?
We had it. We could.
Mr. Chair, I can just tell you what it is, and the page is getting a copy.
The dates correspond to the other two bills?
Exactly, yes, Mr. Chair. The dates correspond exactly to the other two bills.
We understand that, I believe. The committee members understand that? Okay, with the understanding that the dates correspond with the other two bills.
And Mr. Chair, with that, it also deleted the penalty language in the Senate File 507, too.
Senator Pappas will move that amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. I don't see any rulemaking stuff in these bills, which I think is good. Somebody mentioned that there might be, but I don't see any. Is that correct? I want to make sure that what we do here is that what our intent is and not that some agency.
It's really the same bill.
Mr. Chair, do you like us to step away and let testifiers come forward?
Yeah, we've got some people want to speak on this. We're supposed to be out of here at 1:30, but we've got, I understand, we have a little more time. So if the witnesses could be brief, and we'd appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
I assume these are proponents. Is that correct? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
I just have a quick procedural. I'm getting the impression that what they're going to do is move the Marty bill forward. Because they just amended that one?
No, not necessarily.
Mr. Chair, we're discussing with the authors. That's what we would like to have happen. It's the bill that's been through the committee. And again, it has, I think, a good way of addressing the biodegradability. It does allow an exception for it, but it doesn't include that in the definition. It says they have to show that it breaks down.
Mr. Chair, so I just want to be, so kind of the agreement is, and I'm sorry, but I do have to leave. So if we are not going to take action on this today.
Okay, welcome to the committee. And
I'm sorry,
we don't know yet who's going to carry the bill or what.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I just want to confirm that we are not taking action because I have something scheduled with constituents.
Yeah, you could. You're excused.
Thank you so much, sir.
Well, we'd love to have you, though. But
it's just my scheduling, and I just wanted
to
confirm.
I know, and we're supposed to be out of here, but this is extremely important
thank you.
Piece of legislation, so I think we have to take a little time to hear from the witnesses. Welcome, and briefly, if possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Greta Gauthier. I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The MPCA would support Senate File 507 as amended. We do have the legislature last year requested us to do a report on plastic microbeads that is in your packet. I have the author here, but I'm not going to go through the report. If there are questions, we're happy to take them. In the interest of time, the three authors hit most of the high points of our report, but I'm happy to take questions if people have them.
Mr. Chair, I have one question.
Senator Kosaka.
You said you support the Senate File 507. Do you also support Senate File 627 and Senate File 674? I don't think they're identical. Right?
Mr. Chairman and members, you know, our position is that plastic microbeads are made of plastic, and that when plastic left around in the environment is trash, and we're against trash. So we would support the other two bills, but we do support, it seems as though House Senate File 507 is the one that is going to be moving, so that is why I said that.
Thank you.
That's the one moving in the House.
Senate File 507,
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, it's not a technical companion to the House. There are about three or four versions introduced. This is not a technical companion to it. We were going to merge it at the desk, which we've done many times before.
All right. Proceed.
Mr. Chairman, that would conclude my brief remarks unless there are other questions, and referring people once again to the study that came out in December, which the legislature
All right, let's hear from them. Thank you. Sir, you did a great job there.
Mr. Chair, he's the author of the report. He was just here for questions.
Okay. All right. Let's hear from a couple more people, and then we're going to lay this over. And good afternoon, and welcome to the Minnesota Senate Commerce Committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Margaret Bessel. I work with Larkin Hoffman, and we represent the Personal Care Product Council. We actually have appreciated working with Senator Marty on his bill and have been in discussions, but unfortunately today we are here to support Senator Hoffman's bill, Senate File 674, and actually Senator Reinhart's bill 627. I will give you highlights as to why. Those bills represent a large degree of negotiations that went on in the state of Illinois. And basically, the state of Illinois passed this exact the legislation represented from Senator Hoffman and Senator Reinhart, and the Council of State governments adopted it as model legislation. And so Minnesota has an opportunity today to adopt model legislation that would put the state on a level playing field, not only in the state and the nation, but hopefully in the world. Canada is actually looking at adopting this legislation as a North American standard. As it's been said before, the bill has unique definitions that capture three distinct types of products: cosmetics, soaps, which include body washes, and over-the-counter drugs, which are like acne products. Again, you know, we'll continue to work with Senator Marty on his language, but would hope
you'll prefer your group prefers the Senator Hoffman's language. Is that correct?
And as well,
and
as
that's
Senator
the
Reinhart's
one that.
Okay.
I don't think there's support for it.
It's got a preemption.
Okay. Thank you very much. You're welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Lencheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited, here to talk to all three bills. But to be clear, we support Senator Marty's version. We think it takes the right approach to this problem. Just briefly, we have members who fish around the state. We're particularly concerned with Lake Superior because of that. It's an extremely cold environment. And because that's the area, the Great Lakes, where we've documented these microbeads already present. Just briefly, the Great Lakes fishery is a $5 billion a year industry, the recreational fishery. In Minnesota, I'm not sure if it's above $50 million, but it's significant. It's an important part of our quality of life here in Minnesota. We are concerned about the impacts to fish health and thus the productivity of the system, but also ultimately to human consumption. In the PCA report, you didn't get a presentation of it today, but if you take a look at that, UWS and Superior has done some sampling of fish in Lake Superior in the Duluth area. 18% of those fish had microbeads in their stomach. Very concerning. We also know they can get in the sediments. So the key to know about these microbeads is they can act as sort of a sponge and pull in chemicals in the environment. We have PCB problems and other things. And the toxins that get absorbed by the plastic, you know, end up in the fish, and then they move into the fish, and ultimately they move into us. So we're very concerned about the consumption, and I think we need state action. But to this particular bill and why it's important that it's Senate 507, there is no good definition of biodegradability. The structure of Senator Marty's bill is excellent because it just defines a microbead and then says, if you think you have something that is truly biodegradable in Minnesota's cold environment, bring it forward. But I think that is a critical difference, a very important difference. And at least in Minnesota, I think we don't need to take somebody else's model. We can think for ourselves and adapt the bill to our environment. And so I think it makes sense that the onus would be on somebody who wants to propose something as biodegradable to show that. So, thank you.
Okay, any further witnesses? Mr. Quillis, how are you today?
Mr. Chairman, how are you?
I'm
like
fine.
All of us, a little busy during committee deadline weeks.
Mr. Quillis.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. I will be very brief. My name is Tony Quillis. I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Been working with Senator Marty and the industry to go through as this proposal moves through the process. And I want to thank Senator Marty. We've had a couple of good constructive meetings to talk through some of the differences, specifically in the definition area, the time frame, and in the penalties. And as Senator Marty referenced, the A6 amendment is going to take care of some of that. I think there are still some issues probably in the definition section. But, Mr. Chairman, I think the key is, as Ms. Vessel referenced, that you know there is a consistency to get that among all the states that are moving along. And so we'd like to see some consistency for our manufacturers and retailers that we're not changing it between states. So, Mr. Chairman, I want to just thank you for the time to testify on it and thank Senator Marty for some constructive conversations that we've had as this bill's moved through the process.
Okay, Senator Platt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Quillis, and I was going to ask the other testifier as well, but since you're at the table, as I look at the bills, two of them have penalties. One has a preemption, and I haven't heard anybody speak specifically about the preemption. Can you or Senator Reinert talk about that?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, that's Senator Hoffman's bill. So
oh, sorry.
Him coming.
Senator Hoffman, did you hear the question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me? Okay. And that's just that's the difference between the three of us was that we just said that it preempts any ordinance or resolution of the municipality, county, or other local government regarding the synthetic plastic microbeads. So if you'd like, I can get either Jerry Sacker or our testifier up here to go deeper in the weeds on that with you, but that's just the difference right there.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, and I have talked with the industry and said that, you know, if we can make sure we're getting rid of them, including the pseudo-biodegradable ones and so on, if we can make sure we're getting rid of the problem, I'm happy to accept preemption on local governments because I don't see what else there is to preempt if we're getting rid of them. If we're not really going to do it, then I don't think we should be stopping local governments from doing it.
And Mr. Chairman, I support that position as well.
Thank you.
Further discussion. We're going to lay these bills over, and we'll take them up before the second deadline. So that's what we're doing today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion. With that, the committee is adjourned. When did we meet again?
Monday.
See, listen, we've got about four meetings scheduled.
From New
York,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And hope, let's try to get here on time so we can get through the agenda, okay? With that, the meeting is adjourned.